Welcome to Raise Your Vibe and Heal. I am excited to introduce you to Dr. Lauren Belg. I met Lauren a year ago at a meditation retreat and learned of her fabulous background and that she had written a book, Near Death in the ICU, Stories from Patients Near Death and Why We Should Listen to Them. On today's episode, we are going to talk about her journey going from a high school student who had undiagnosed dyslexia, how it took her 6 years before she even went to college. And the only reason she did is because she had what she calls a thought drop, basically her intuition, guiding her to go to college and not only college, but to med school. We're going to talk about her journey as a physician, as well as the patient experiences that she shares in her book. If you are watching on my YouTube channel, I've got a screenshot of her book from Amazon. She has over 1,600 reviews on Amazon with a 4.6 star rating. And on Goodreads, she has over 900 reviews with 4.5 star review rating. Dr. Lauren considers this a labor of love with this book, is truly why she did this. It is an act of service, and that is why I was so excited to have her on today's podcast. Dr. Lauren Belg is a critical care specialist who has worked in the ICU for more than 2 decades at the bedside of patients who are critically ill, are dying, or have been brought back to life after a scientifically confirmed death. In that mysterious space, she has observed many things she can't explain. She has developed a passion and literacy for talking with patients about their anomalous experiences during resuscitation from clinical death, severe trauma, and even while under anesthesia. These include near-death and out-of-body experiences, bedside visitations, and visions, things that can't be readily explained by our limited 3D physical explanations for existence. In her award-winning book, Near Death in the ICU, Stories from Patients Near Death and Why We Should Listen to Them, she makes a case for not only the importance of honoring the truth of patients' experiences we can't prove didn't happen, but also what we can learn from them to inform our own spiritual growth. It is my honor and my deepest pleasure to welcome Dr. Lauren Belg to the podcast. Welcome, Lauren, to the podcast.
Thank you, Lisa. Thank you so much for having me on. This is a real treat.
Thank you for being here. I enjoyed meeting you a year ago at a meditation retreat that we both attended, and I just was fascinated with your story. And then when I found out that you wrote a book, Near Death in the ICU, Stories from Patients Near Death and Why We Should Listen to Them, I wanted to learn more about you. And by the way, your book is such an easy read. Highly recommend you can check it out on Amazon. It was so full of compassion and so full of who you are that I just wanted to share your story and share your experiences here with the listeners. So
Thank you for being here. I appreciate you.
Thank you. Well, can we start a little bit about you? Start off with a little bit about your background, please.
I do think that my background is pertinent to who I am now. I mean, that's true for all of us, right? We are a product of who we were and who we are becoming. I grew up in the Deep South in South Alabama. My accent these days is very adapted to where I am in Wisconsin. But I grew up as the child of a Southern Baptist preacher. And in the Deep South, the prescription for belief systems is very constrained. And that's very comforting for a lot of people. And I certainly don't discount that. It is a path for so many and brings a lot of joy and growth and hope and sustenance and solace. For me, it was always discordant. Even as a young child, I feel like I was born with this question that I carried with me along my spiritual evolution. And it actually started with, I don't know that I believe this the way that it's being presented. And that was the simple question. I didn't have, you know, a very evolved thought about what it meant. I just thought, I'm not sure that this rings true to me. This doesn't seem like my truth. And I think that's important for me to realize now, for those of your listeners who might read the book, it focuses a lot on respecting and listening to and honoring people's truth. So for me to be born with that question seems very important for how I interact with patients now. For me, my spiritual journey is a situation very much unfolding. It still informs me today, but I think I would not be able to interact with patients the way that I do now had I not carried that question of what is my personal truth when starting when I was very young.
So you had these questions when you were younger. Did you ever talk about this with your parents, or
I
was
tried.
This
okay?
I tried. How did that conversation go? I'm just curious. I'm kind of
well.
Curious,
I mean,
especially in the Deep South.
Yeah, so I had a really good friend who was not only Black, she was Catholic, and I mean that's
oh boy,
so, I know
in the Deep South. Yes, okay.
A really good friend who in second grade, she and I were very fringe. You know, neither of us quite fit in. It was just after desegregation. So my friend, whom I will call Susan, if anyone can trace this, I want to protect her memory because she is no longer living. But she and I were so close from the very beginning, instant friends. And I wanted to have her over like you do when you're young and in second grade. And that was not allowed. And it was hard for me to understand that. I understood racial boundaries because that's one of the first things that you're indoctrinated into are racial boundaries. Mm-hmm. And the ludicrous nature of these boundaries doesn't really dawn on the people who are raising you. But I was told, you know, Catholic, that's a no-no. They're not Christians. Now I know that's ludicrous. For you to have a Black friend, that's not acceptable. Now I know that's ludicrous. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, Susan passed away during the school year when we were very young. She had a horrible headache and didn't wake up. What I think now is that she probably had an aneurysm that ruptured based on her symptoms. But that was devastating to me, but it was pivotal because I wanted to go to her funeral and I was not allowed to go.
Oh.
And that really informed me and helped me understand that this path is not my path. I can't stay in the Deep South. I cannot stay in this faith path. I can't stay in this context. And that has continued to inform me because we are, by nature, we are tribal beings and we gravitate to people that are most like us. And I should have gravitated naturally to the people in my tribe that I was born into, but didn't. That also kind of prepared me for talking about things that are not safe. And now that in the medical world, talking about near-death experiences, I understood from the get-go that that was not going to be safe to talk about. And looking back on what I was born into, I can see a design of, you know, we're going to give you some practice, whoever the we are, my guides, you know, spirit, whatever, whoever that committee of we's happened to be, it's like, we're going to, you know, ease you into this, learning your truth, understanding that this is not your path, and that's going to prepare you for respecting other people's truths. I've followed that thread in my faith journey, and I've followed that thread in my medical journey as well. And I see them as intertwined and related to each other.
That takes a lot of courage to do that, to not be in alignment with the family belief system and mm-hmm. to be able to have the courage to use your voice. And obviously, when you read the book, you are in a way an advocate for your patients by sharing these stories. Mm. And so I find it really interesting that you had this early experience with a young childhood friend. Was it that experience that encouraged you to be a physician, or how did that happen?
My husband calls these moments that I have thought drops where I, you know, just take a sharp right detour from where I'm headed. I did not go straight to college out of high school. There was a 6-year delay. And a lot of that had to do with my belief, errant belief, that I didn't have what it takes to enter into a higher level of education. So I have a learning disability. I have dyslexia, and that has made it so difficult for me to study, to learn new material. Something that can take someone an hour to learn and study, it takes me 3 to 4 hours. And that has always been daunting. So I felt like that wasn't part of my path. And I was sitting on my mother's balcony one summer before I actually entered in college. And I had this thought drop of you should go to medical school and become a doctor. It did not feel like an original thought.
No.
So far from my sensibilities and my belief about myself that I thought it was so strange, but it, you know, it was a hook that was cast and sunk deeply into me and would not let go. So from that moment on, I was applying to college, proclaiming that I was a pre-med student, and it was not easy, but it was meant to be. And, you know, medical school is difficult. It's competitive. It's difficult to get in. I applied to one school, which is dumb. That's not a good idea to be
successful. Well, it's just out of, it's not part, you're not in the mold here, Lauren. You broke the mold. I mean, first of all, if you watch TV, people who go to med school, typically they're all through high school. They're like, I'm going to be a doctor. I need to get the straight A's. I need to go to this school. I need to go to that school. And here you are 6 years after, did you say 6 years after high school?
After high school.
Okay. Well, that's
going
not,
into college.
That's,
yeah.
Well, not even, yes. So there was a 6 year delay there. Did you have dyslexia diagnosis at that time or was it later on?
No. I mean, I knew that I had trouble reading, mm-hmm. a lot of trouble. And that idea had been floated to my family, okay. by teachers, but I had never gone through any formal testing until I got to higher education. And I had a professor who said, I think there's a diagnosis here. I went to school in Tennessee, medical school at the University of Tennessee. And I can look back and see I was guided to the right schools, the right professors who really recognized something in me, both potential, but also some difficulty. And that prompted going through formal testing, getting a formal diagnosis of dyslexia and the accommodation for testing that came with that, because I did poorly on exams because I couldn't finish them. Mm-hmm. And then whenever I was able to have the extended time, which I still have that today, anytime I take a board exam, that made all the difference. And so I am so grateful for the people who were placed in my pathway to help me on my journey. But looking back, as hard as it was, I'm grateful for that diagnosis. I'm grateful to have gone through that difficulty because I see things that other people don't notice. Because when you have a learning disability, you have to interact with the world in a different way to get the information and assimilate it. And I do feel like that has been an advantage, even though it did not feel like it at the time at all.
I love this. I did not know this about you before we sat down and are having this conversation. So what I'm hearing you say is that you had a moment of clarity. You had a moment where the thought dropped, where your higher self, spirit, whomever you identify with, was able to get that information to you. And you just instantly knew that wasn't my thought. That's how it is as a medium when I am able to share information. It's like I wasn't thinking about XYZ and all of a sudden something pops into my head. Okay, so you're naturally listening to your intuition, your guidance. So then you go to college and even with this belief system that you have this learning issue or something that's outside of the norm and right. you're guided to the right school. And what I love about this, Lauren, is that you are paying attention to your guidance and your wisdom, because so many times we think, where's our guidance? We don't have any help, blah, blah, blah. Well, here's an example of you following the breadcrumbs. You're listening and you're being guided appropriately. What is it like to study? Not only are you studying, you're in college, but you're preparing for a very difficult curriculum in the medical profession. You must have so much information that you have to Well, you do. You have so much information that you have to memorize and learn. What's it like to have dyslexia and learn all this material at the same time? Can you just give us an example of what that's like?
Yeah. Actually, a very clear example. There are several different varieties of dyslexia. I believe that there are upwards of 15 different kinds. So most people will say you mix your B's and your D's. It's rarely as simplistic as that. So my form of dyslexia, I will see a group of letters and my brain is processing that quicker than my optic path, and it takes that group of letters and will form it into a word that it thinks that it is, except you will accept that interpretation of the word until you get far enough along in a sentence or a paragraph where you're like, okay, that doesn't make sense.
So you have to start over again.
Yeah. Yeah. And I'm sure that, you know, perhaps even some of your listeners will recognize that as of like, oh my gosh, I misread words all the time. So groups of letters misinterpreted, and it's not a delay. Your brain, that machine that is your brain, is processing that group of letters and forming it into a word that is inaccurate. And you don't recognize it until you're deep into a sentence. And it makes you nervous to read out loud because you don't want to. Even now, whenever I have to read out loud, I break out in a cold sweat and get palpitations because it's a fear. It's not a stuttering over words. It's reading a word incorrectly. Okay. And affecting the context of the whole group of words that form the sentence in the paragraph that I've read. And so that makes it difficult to study. It makes it difficult to take a test because you think you're on the right track until you realize you're not, and you have to back up.
Now take us from going through med school, and you write in the book that you went through a personal crisis. Can you share a little bit of that with us, please?
So I was married to my first husband, you know, right out of college. We met, as many people do in college, and had a lot in common, very good friends. And during medical school, which is tough on any relationship, my husband asked for a divorce. I was blindsided by that. I was just devastated by it. And it happened to be right before what we call step two of the licensing exams. You take one at the end of 2 years that covers the academic content of medicine. And then you take another at the end of your third, beginning of your fourth year that covers basic clinical skills and incorporates that knowledge. And so it was right before that exam in my fourth year of medical school that my husband at that time asked for a divorce. I went into a deep despair. And it was really difficult. I mean, the darkness of depression, I certainly understand that because I lived that in that moment of barely having enough energy to get up and go to medical school. And then the anger of, your timing is very poor, sir, when I was preparing for, you know, one of the biggest exams of my career. I lost weight. I didn't eat much. I slept a lot. I was still, you know, the responsible medical student. We get up, go do my rotations, come back, go to bed. And it was during one of these periods of just feeling so dark and down that I awakened in the middle of the night, but I looked up and there were two blue orbs, one larger and one smaller, that were just kind of floating in the corner of the room. It caught my attention. And I thought that it was probably an external illumination. There was a small window in a bathroom nearby. And I thought, well, that would be the angle that it's coming from. But I got up and looked out that window. There was nothing. And so I crawled back in bed and just kind of watched them. And they were not static. They kind of drifted apart and back together. And then, you know, I would drift in and out of some level of sleep, but I was still aware of my surroundings. So it had to be a very surface level of sleep. And one time I opened my eyes and I didn't see them. And I was looking around and I saw them on another part of the wall up near the corner. I got up and, you know, I'm looking at them. From underneath, I could see form. I could see a three-dimensional form to them. I'm thinking now, like, why didn't I reach up and touch it? I don't know. There was a little bit of fear there, or not fear, reserve.
Okay.
I did not feel afraid. I was very aware that this is something of substance in my environment that I cannot discount with external explanations. And so I just crawled back in bed and watched them. And then I went to sleep and into a deep sleep. And I woke up the next day and I felt different. I felt lighter. I felt like some of the depression had lifted. I tie it to whoever these two little orbs were, or, you know, spirit or angels or my guides. I don't know, but it was something that I experienced that was not typical and not explained by my scientific sensibilities at the time. as deeply immersed in medicine as I was.
Well, clearly there was a type of healing that happened for you to wake up and have comfort and be in a different state. So what got you interested in writing this book about near-death experiences? Can you just walk us through a little bit of that, please?
Sure. Well, I mean, I have to go forward quite a bit because I wrote the book. I started writing it in 2013. It was published in 2015. But there was a sentinel moment where one of the surgeons that I was working with, and he and I, you know, have a really good relationship. And we happened to be seeing a patient at the same time. My work is in the intensive care unit. I'm there all day. My office is in the intensive care unit, and surgeons kind of come and go. You know, they're in their offices seeing outpatients, they're in the operating room. But it happened that this surgeon, this friend of mine, and I were approaching this patient's room at the same time. And this patient was really excited about to share something that had happened to her while she was under anesthesia. She had an out-of-body experience where she was floating above her surgery and was able to describe to the surgeon and myself elements about the surgery, about the room that she should not have known, including some of the people who were present that she had never met, some of the, you know, the OR nurses, the assistants, and details that would be impossible for her to know under anesthesia. And my surgeon friend, well-meaning, of course, said, well, you have to understand that the, you know, anesthesia can do some funny things to the brain. And I elbowed him and said, do not stomp on her truth. And we all laughed about it. And it was, you know, it was someone I had a really good relationship with, and he was able to pivot, and he still didn't believe it. But we had a chat after that, and he said, well, I'm not sure what that was. I'm like, you don't need to know what that was. What's important is that you honor her truth, and that's part of good patient care. And what would it be like to, instead of saying, you know, your brain can do funny things, what would it look like to say, wow, that's really interesting. Tell me more. What do you think it means? Because you and I, surgeon friend, we do not know what that means. But we know that it's experience that she had, and listening to her is the most important thing. So that moment really prompted me to look back on some of the experiences I'd had with patients over the years, starting with when I was a brand new intern out of medical school. And I understood that I had something important to offer the medical community, something to contribute to the conversation, that listening to these anomalous experiences of patients is not only a kindness, it's a part of good patient care to honor their truth without interpretation, and to realize that, you know, it doesn't matter. Our belief or lack of belief in these phenomenon matters so little, and so little, in fact, that it matters not at all. But what does matter is the fact that something happened that has caught the patient's attention. We can't tell them it didn't happen. They can't prove to us it did happen. So that really shifts the conversation and the important question to, what did it mean to you? That's so interesting. Tell me more about it. And just set them up as a provider of their medical care to entertain the question and explore it instead of shutting it down. And I've heard from patients over the years that if they're shut down by this respected figure, they can enter into a space that is so unnecessary of questioning the validity of something that has the potential to offer them a rich moment of growth.
Well, you just gave us some great tips on how to talk with our family and friends if they're experiencing something like that. And that's actually a great point for most anything. It's like if somebody has their own personal experience and truth, and if you haven't walked in their shoes, how can we place judgment on that? And so just coming from a place of kindness and coming from our heart, it's what you're doing is you're coming from our heart center and you're sharing, look, I'm going to love and I'm going to support you. And just listen. I feel like that's a great lesson for all of us. I want to talk a little bit about when patients are in comas. Are patients aware when they're in comas, or are they not aware? What have you heard from patients?
Well, I mean, this just segues from what we were talking about, not being able to prove or disprove a patient's personal experience. I always assume that patients can hear us. And one of the things that I have championed over the years with bedside providers is please be careful what you're saying at the bedside. It matters. And sometimes you will hear conversations that are not only unhelpful, but sometimes inappropriate. And that has always bothered me. Now that I am in an attending role and have, you know, some supervision over the people in the ICU where I'm working, one of the things that I emphasize over and over is please be careful what you're saying at the bedside. Keep it positive. Don't talk about the patient's diagnoses in a way that might give them a thread to hold on to that will tell them on a deep level that they're not getting better, because we don't know. We create the best possible environment with our medications and our technology for the patient to improve, and the rest is simply not up to us. But there are narrative strings that really matter that I do believe that a patient on some level can hold on to. And I've had patients come out of impossible situations and where we were able to even measure with a little EEG strip the depths of sedation where they should not physically be able to recount any conversations, except they do. And it's not common, but it's not unheard of that patients on deep sedation will still be able to snatch moments of clarity out of their surroundings and relay them to us later. So I always tell families, especially who are at the bedsides of their loved ones holding visual, especially if our care has shifted to supporting a dying process, to say, I tell them, this is the time to say important things, ask forgiveness, tell them you love them, express gratitude for everything they've given you, because we don't know what they do and do not hear. And I do believe, after years of personal experience, that patients do receive information on multiple levels, and hospice workers, people who are in the field and notice subtleties because they're at the bedside in that capacity for their career, will tell us hearing is the last to go.
Wow. I'm loving and I'm resonating with everything that you're saying here. And this reminds me of a time when I was once a hospice volunteer. This was prior to the pandemic. And I was sitting with a patient in the 11th hour and they're actively transitioning and family needed a break. And so I was there from 8 p.m. until midnight, until a family relative was able to take over. I had the honor of sitting with a patient for 4 hours, and I just had this sense that even though her eyes were closed, that she was aware on some level of my being there. And I had not met this patient prior to this experience. And I remember sharing with her, like, she would make little movements, and I just got this sense like she was trying to communicate with me, even though they're just subtle, subtle micro movements. And I would talk with her and I'd be like, I see you smiling there. I can tell you're smiling. And I could feel her. I'm getting emotional just talking about this. I could feel her energy just shift just by communicating with her and speaking with her. Oh my gosh, I think she's in the room right now. I could feel her energy shifting. I could feel her gratitude. I could feel her appreciation. And I just spoke with her with kindness and love, and it was such an honor to be a part of her part of her journey as she was transitioning. And I left at midnight, and the relative came to sit with her. And 5 minutes after I left, she transitioned. Oh, wow. And yeah, and I was notified the next day by the hospice coordinator that she had transitioned, and the hospice coordinator had felt that my energy helped her transition and helped with her process. So if I can do that as somebody who, I don't know this woman, I just showed up and I just was present. I didn't read a book. I just talked with her. I, you know, kind of just gently touched her arm and just was present with her while she was in this process. Can you imagine the impact a family member and a loved one can have and just be, you know, be able to be present and just extend so much love? And what's so cool about this, Lauren, is that the next day I was out of town, I was in a hotel, and there were a couple other people in the room, the lights are off, and I turned in the bed, and the lamp next to the bed had this glow that was unearthly. Oh, it was just this glow. And I instantly knew that was her way of saying thank you.
Oh,
so
my gosh.
I love that you are talking with patients, you are talking and you're educating the, you know, those that you work with about this, because we are energetic beings and come from a place of kindness and love and compassion and from heart center, that we can literally change and alter another person's experience just by being present. So I'm going to shift gears here a little bit. You had shared a story about your grandmother in the book, and I would love for you to share that experience with our listeners, please.
Sure. So my grandmother and grandfather, very basic, you know, farmer people in South Alabama. Wonderful. You know, I had a wonderful connection with both of them. And when I say basic, I mean, that was more from a lifestyle. They were both very interesting, kind people. And I, you know, my grandfather had some psychic sensibilities. And from the, you know, the Southern Baptist perspective, he would regard it as like the gift of prophecy, you know, in the context of, you know, the biblical interpretation. But he was very intuitive. And my grandmother was more practical and would accepted my grandfather and his ability, which we didn't see that much of it. He didn't walk around in a cloud of all knowing in ways that impacted our lives. But there would be snippets over the years that I would see where it was clear to me he knew something that he couldn't know otherwise, except from a non-physical source of a non-physical informant. So my grandmother was dying, kind of a slow decline over years from dementia, and had some heart failure. And she entered into hospice at home, and we were all able to be present. And it was lovely. I mean, she had bedside conversations, which, by the way, under the burden of truth, most physicians will accept bedside conversations as a symbol of approaching death.
Really?
Even if they don't have a distinctly religious interpretation, even if they're very grounded in science, will still say they're having bedside conversations, the end must be near. And I think that has to do with the fact that we see that so often.
Okay.
And it's the burden of proof, you know, the repetitive association that tells us that we can safely draw that conclusion for people who do not feel like it's safe to draw conclusions from things they can't hold, touch, and feel.
You have a beautiful way of wording things, Lauren. you're straddling both fences here, and it's a great way of presenting the information in a very safe and effective manner.
Don't shut down the conversation.
By the way, before we go down that road, I just have to ask a question. Your grandfather, is that on your mom or your dad's side?
Your mom.
Okay. I had a feeling, because it has been my experience that a lot of the intuitive gifts and I believe my mediumship abilities, intuitive abilities, healing abilities, came from my mother's side of the family. Mm-hmm. And so you clearly have a great connection with your intuition, your inner wisdom, inner guidance. Mm-hmm. And so as you were speaking, I thought, I bet you this is her mom's side of the family. So anyways, okay. I just wanted to share that little tidbit. So let's keep going.
Sure. Yeah. So my grandmother was in her bedroom and having these bedside visitations, and she would say things like, oh, look at that rose. Thank you. Interacting that you brought that for me. I mean, she was having these conversations with people that we couldn't see. And it was so clear and really went against the level of cognitive clouding that she had over the preceding several months. And then she would say things like almost, almost. And there are several layers to this story. There were two doves outside of her window on this metal glider, kind of a rocking glider from like the 1950s, 60s. And they were right outside her window, and they were just there and interacting, and they would fly away and then come back, and fly away and come back. And then there was one, and it was just one dove. And right before, you know, she passed, this dove flew away and she died. And shortly after she died, we heard this horn off in the distance, like a trumpet horn. And that was just, we all looked at each other. And they lived in the, they lived in the middle of nowhere, in the middle of cotton fields.
Okay.
I mean, they lived in the middle of 100 acres and nothing but swamp around a big part of the, I mean, to the western edge and the southern edge, there's swamp. And then to the left, there are other farms, no train track, no big wheeler, 18 wheelers. It didn't even sound like that. It sounded like a melodic trumpet. And my grandfather said, I guess she's gone now. And we never saw those doves again. We all heard it. I had frequently had the thought, whatever other faith traditions have as a sentinel that the person has transitioned, if we had been Muslim, would we have experienced something different? Would, mm-hmm. you know, or, you know, Native American, would we have experienced something different? But from that, you know, that Christian faith tradition, what we heard was what my grandfather called Gabriel's horn. And multiple people in the room, in the house, outside, heard it.
Didn't the hospice nurse make a comment that that was only the second time that she had ever heard that?
Oh, yeah.
I think you mentioned that in your book. Yeah.
Yeah. So this, I'd forgotten about that. Thank you. So the hospice worker was there and she was just, you know, tearful. And she just said that that's the second time I've heard that.
Oh.
And it was so reassuring to us and, you know, bolstered faith in whatever way the my relatives in the room understood that. And I had since really kind of pulled away from the typical Christian tradition in my faith journey. But it was a moment that kind of brought me back to the faith of my people, as it were. And I was able to have a moment where I recognized common ground and a common belief that we just don't understand.
Oh my gosh. This whole conversation is just giving me chills. And for those of you who are familiar with my work, when my team comes around, I'll say my guides that work with me, when they first introduced themselves to me almost 9 years ago, I could smell bonfire smoke. It's a psychic sense of smell. And this whole conversation is just coming wave after wave after wave of this. So that's a way of spirit putting so much love around this conversation we're having here today. Lauren, wow. Okay. How does this translate into your work and the physicians that you work with and the nurses that you work with? I know you have the opportunity to do some education now, but prior to being in a position of management, did I say that correctly? A management position or?
Well, I'm not in management. I've worked as the medical director of the ICU in my past. And as I've gotten older, I've stepped out of those responsibilities and have always worked as a bedside physician. And I still continue to do that. I've never been in administration or management.
Okay. So I misspoke. When I was thinking of management, I was thinking of like a lead physician. I wasn't thinking like being in the business side. So I completely misspoke. So you're in a position of guiding and supervising other medical professionals. So that would be a medical director. So prior to being in that type of a role, were you able to speak with the other physicians and nurses openly about this? Or is this something that you just had to let evolve naturally? I mean, how?
Well, I didn't for a long time. I didn't speak about it openly because I didn't think it was safe. And I think other providers of all different specialties, from ancillary staff, like physical therapists, respiratory therapists, RNs, different people who interact to support patients' healing. I think there are probably many people who would say they don't feel like that environment is safe to talk about things that are not scientifically proven.
Okay.
And I learned that early on. My very first experience that really made me want to start writing things down and journaling about them was it was literally my very first month as a brand new doctor right out of medical school. And I was doing an internal medicine residency and I was on the wards, the medical wards. And I had a patient under my care who refused a life-saving surgery because of an out-of-body experience he had had during a previous surgery that informed his decision-making. And I still to this day feel that if I knew then what I know now, he might have made a different choice. So I carry some responsibility for that a patient under my care died because I fail to recognize an out-of-body experience for what it was, and to be able to talk to him about the fact that it wasn't a danger, but it was so frightening to him. He had had an abdominal surgery some years prior that he witnessed from up above in a way that he would not have been able to because of the sterile drape that actually comes up between the patient's head and the sterile area of the abdominal surgery he was having. But he described in great detail the surgery, his open abdomen, and it freaked him out. And I didn't know what to make of this. At that point in time, I mean, I was so saturated in medical science. I was still trying to fit it into something that had a rational explanation. I didn't know if maybe it was kind of a fugue state or, you know, something I just had not come across. There's a hierarchy in medical training. You know, the intern is, you know, the very beginning of a supervising role where I had medical students under me.
Okay.
And so then I go to my resident who is above me. And then you have the fellow who is doing a higher level of training, maybe in a specialty, and then the attending physician. So I went to my resident, my next in command, and I told him what had happened. And he said to me, on rounds, whenever you tell our attending about what is going on with this patient that in the book I call Samuel, I wouldn't say that.
Okay.
And so that was the first experience I had of feeling like it wasn't safe to talk about anomalous experiences in a medical environment, but it stuck with me. I mean, I was haunted by that. He refused life-saving surgery and actually had scar tissue in his abdomen that twisted and choked off the bowels and killed part of, you know, cut off the blood supply, and he had dead bowel, and he died from that. And he died in the room with, you know, morphine for pain and his family by his side. And I just was unsettled by that experience. Like, what happened then that he, you know, 10 years ago that he, what was he experiencing? So I went down to the medical records. This was before the electronic medical records. We actually had to go down into the bowels of the hospital and request the thick manila envelopes, and you couldn't leave with them. You had to stay down there. So I knew when he had had his surgery, and I thought, if it had been something physical that he had experienced, there should have been vital signs that indicated that. So if he was having pain or he was having anxiety or was awake under anesthesia, that which happens, it's rare, but they can appear to be anesthetized but still be awake under there. He should have had markers of pain, like an elevated blood pressure, increased heart rate, increased respiratory rate. So I found his flow sheet, the sheet from the anesthesiologist that documented all of the vital signs during that surgery, and they were normal during the whole surgery. And I read the surgeon's note, no complications, it went really well, and he didn't develop any problems until 10 years later when the scar tissue started to kind of twist his bowel. But there was nothing in the records to suggest that this was a physical experience.
Sure. And so
that really stuck with me, and I became curious. And as I went through medical training and my medical practice after I'd finished my critical care fellowship, I became increasingly curious about anomalous experiences that patients have around moments of physical death or severe illness or anesthesia, and, you know, found that some of the overlaps of these experiences, the near-death experience, the out-of-body experience, really is a spectrum, and that the patient's experiences are so different and varied. And one thing I've learned over the years in talking with patients about it, because I have become more emboldened when I understood that patients want to talk about it, is many patients will discount their experiences because they don't fit the scaffolding that has been placed upon these experiences, like the tunnel of light. Did you see a tunnel? Well, no, I didn't, but this is what happened. Well, I don't think that was a near-death experience. I mean, how dare we interpret an anomalous experience like that? But there are probably far more anomalous experiences that occur in patients with patients who are in the environment of almost dying or at risk of dying or extreme pain or under anesthesia, or critical illness of any kind. I've seen it across the spectrum in my career because I'm looking for it and asking about it. And I think when people who do near-death experience research say that, you know, probably 2% of the population experience these things. When you look at the experiences that I document in my book, that's over 15 years. Mm-hmm. And so when you think of the number of patients that I care for in a year, that really does fit the 2%. I think it's probably more.
Okay.
If we broadened the definition of an anomalous experience. We saw that spectrum in COVID, where we had patients who survived, but were with us for 8 weeks, 10 okay. weeks. You know, patients who did survive, it was such a long recovery because of the damage to lung tissue and their dependency on ventilators and that slow recovery. And one of the experiences if I ever do a second edition of this book, it will certainly have some experiences from COVID. But one patient described a myriad of different experiences over his almost 2.5 months with us. And he talked about moments where he would come out of his body and be able to see himself, see us, go back in his body, but his eyes were closed. Sometimes he was prone, like, you know, you've heard that we would have to do with patients is put them on their stomach. We didn't know this was going on until he came out and he told us, and he was pretty excited about his experience. And we didn't even have to ask, did anything unusual happen?
He just told you.
he was so excited to talk about it. And so it was impossible to match his experience to specific dates because it was such a long, protracted illness. But some of the personnel he described and some of the things that were happening, he could see himself prone. He could see himself on his face. And that's impossible physically. If he's describing things in the room that are real, then you have to stretch your acceptance to another explanation.
Well, okay. I would like to just share, I think Samuel was a great teacher for you. And you know this. Excuse me. Hold on a second. He wasn't a smoker by any chance, was he?
I don't really know. I don't recall that.
Yeah, okay. That's interesting.
It wouldn't be surprising because he was a military man and front lines and
okay,
that was responsible for his first surgery.
That's really interesting because I just got a sudden increase of flow on the right side of my nose. It went down the throat and on the right side of the nose. Like, that's very interesting. Okay. Spirit's around. Okay. So I'm going to try and
spirit around.
I'm going to get back into my left brain here. Back in my left brain here. He was a great teacher for you. And also just remembering that it's ultimately, you know this. I mean, I'm not trying to tell you what you don't already know, but it was his choice. It was his time and it was his decision. And ultimately, if that's the beauty of free will, is that if you want to make that choice and if that's what you want to do, that's his responsibility. It's his choice. And mm-hmm. he was, again, great teacher for you. And because of that experience, it started this whole new trajectory for you. Such a fabulous story. And I hope you do write a second book because I couldn't put this one down. It was just went so fast. And you're such a great, for somebody who says she has dyslexia, you really have a way with words and the way you're able to put them on paper. It's just amazing. I love that.
Thank you.
I do. The final thing I want to kind of touch base on is, have you noticed any change in the medical professional community as far as NDEs, OBEs? Has it shifted and changed over the years? Is it still fairly similar to what it was when you first started off as a brand new doctor?
It's interesting. I give that a lot of thought. I don't know if it's things have shifted or I have shifted. I think it may be a combination of both. But okay. What I have noticed is that those medical professionals who work consistently day in, day out in a life and death situation, professionals who work with patients who are at that cutting edge where it could go either way, what I've observed, especially with my physician colleagues, is in the ICU, in the emergency room, you know, in the perioperative period, in hospice, those specialties, people who, you know, swim in those waters every day tend to be more open-minded about these experiences because they observe things they can't explain. Patients share with them things they can't explain. And so I think it may be not necessarily medicine in general, but tribal, as it were, like whatever tribe that you're aligned with in the medical profession tends to be more open. I do have one story to share that's not in the book.
Okay.
But I think it's really quite special that, you know, if I do a second edition, we'll definitely be in there. This book, because of the sense of it not being safe to talk about, it was the kind of book I felt like I had to write, but it was the kind of book I floated into the world hoping nobody I knew would read it.
Okay.
Especially the people that I work with, because that's how unsafe it felt to me in that environment. So there is a surgeon, he's now retired, but there's a surgeon that has a rather imposing personality. Mm-hmm. And he doesn't say much, and he's very intimidating, and he has that aura. And I, too, you know, I feel like I can speak pretty well in an environment where I feel comfortable. But he was the kind of person I would stutter around or lose my words. You know, it's just who he was.
Sure.
But excellent surgeon. And so because I am camped out in the ICU for my entire time that I'm at work, people know where to find me. And usually a surgeon or a cardiologist or a urologist will come find me to say, we need your help as a consultant to manage the ventilator or to manage the non-surgical things. And so that's often our interaction. And so this particular surgeon came up to me and he's just kind of standing there and, you know, I'm feeling intimidated by him like everybody does, and just waiting for him to ask my help with a patient. And then I noticed something's different though. And he's looking around to see if anybody's behind him or around him. And I had no idea what was going to come out of his mouth. And he said, "I read your book." And my response was, I had no idea if he was going to say that's a bunch of malarkey, because he was that age where he would have said malarkey. I didn't know if he was going to be angry and say how irresponsible of you to go down a fanciful path when we're talking about patients' lives. I had no idea what he was going to say. And then he looked around again and he said, "It's true." And I'm speechless. I'm just waiting. Like, what else are you going to put into this space? And he said, he told me about his near-death experience when he was 14, when he drowned. It was really quite emotional. I could tell that he was having to speak in a very, very restrained way, in a measured way. And I say something in my book about the fact that it's not safe in the medical environment to talk about such things. And he spoke to that. He said, "You're right, it's not safe. And I've never told anybody about it in the medical environment, in our medical world, until this moment." And I still felt, you know, we weren't suddenly chums.
No.
And I still, until he retired, I still felt intimidated by him because he just had that kind of persona. But I had such a deep respect and admiration and just saw him in such a different way and felt differently about being brave and having the courage to speak out.
Well, I just want to say it came full circle because you felt like you wish you had known more, which you didn't, because you were new when we were working with Samuel. And now here you have this respected physician that you would have never expected to share this experience with you. And it may have been the first time that he felt safe sharing that experience with somebody. So because of your willingness, your courage, and your beautiful way of articulating these stories in such a respectful and kind manner, it gave him the courage to speak up and share that with you. So, wow, what a gift, Lauren. I could literally talk with you for a whole nother hour or 2 hours. You are just a fascinating guest. And I really, really hope, my friend, that you write another book, because the way you communicate is just beautiful. If you are interested in checking out Lauren's book, I encourage you to get your copy today. Near Death in the ICU, Stories from Patients Near Death and Why We Should Listen to Them. I will have a link in the show notes if you are interested in purchasing this beautiful book. Highly, highly, highly recommend. And no, Lauren did not pay me to say these things. I have guests on here that I personally have worked with or experienced or have met, and I'm just touched by their stories. And Lauren, you have truly touched my life. And I am so grateful that you took the time today to share your journey and to share your beautiful book with us. So thank you. Thank you so much. And for those of you that are listening today, thank you so much for listening. We appreciate you so much. And always remember, until next time, we are fully supported. We are fully protected. And we are fully loved. Thank you. Love and blessings.